everyone. Welcome back to the Early Education Show. It's a delight to be back with you again. We're back for regular episodes throughout 2023. I hope people are happy to have us back. I hope they enjoyed the first episode. But I'm Liam, and I'm sitting here on beautiful Ngunnawal land.
And I'm Lisa, and I'm here on Darkinyul land.
And I'm Carl, the guest for the day, the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, land that was never ceded.
That's so exciting. Welcome, Carl. So we're really covering some geographic area today. But yes, of course, the podcast could not return without, I think I've made this comparison before, it's like the fifth Beatle. It's like the fourth podcaster is Carl Hesiod. So Carl, welcome back to the Early Education Show. It's obviously been a while since you've been on. But I don't think much has happened over the last couple of years. How are you traveling?
It's been pretty quiet, I suppose. Nothing springs to mind, I've got to be honest. it's thank you for the introduction, Liam, and it's wonderful to come and catch up with you all again. I really appreciate the opportunity to.
Well, long-time listeners will know that we get Carl on for very specific episodes, and that's episodes that have anything to do with finance or monetary policy, because I don't understand any of it. So Carl is brought on. It's sort of like a seeing eye assistance for financially illiterate people. So Carl, thank you very much for coming
and
on.
And I put myself in that category too. I think Leanne kind of understands a bit of it, but you and I are write-offs, Liam.
No, you're welcome. I think in this particular case, I'm probably half a step ahead of you, but that sometimes makes all the difference, right? So we'll see how we roll.
Beautiful. So the topic we're going to be talking about today is, so as we sort of talked about in our intro last episode, I should say, there's just quite a lot of inquiries and reviews and various things in the pipeline at the moment. And so we've got topics for, you know, probably the next year or so. One of the ones we wanted to tackle was the ACCC inquiry into early education. Now, the ACCC doesn't often sort of cross paths with early education policy or practice or pedagogy and all those things, but it is really, really important. I will say Lisa's been banging the drum for us to talk about this as soon as possible, because it will have sort of far-reaching impacts on the way the sector runs, the way the sector operates, and particularly the model for how early education is provided. But I think if you're like me, you don't have a huge amount of knowledge about what the ACCC is. Like, the first thing we probably need to do is just start with, you know, what on earth is the ACCC? And Lisa, I might point to you, because you were very insistent that we cover this topic. So I am going to have to put you on the spot first. So are you happy to give us just a really quick background? What is the ACCC?
I'm not sure I actually know enough about that, but the Australian Commission Consumer I don't even know what their initials stand. Commission.
Competition and Consumer Commission.
But basically, they look at things like competition between entities and how government policy interacts with that, and whether entities should be able to take over another entity. One of the things that they did in our sector a few years ago was that they stopped, I think it was, Carl might correct me if I'm wrong, but JAG from taking over Camp Australia. They're two of the biggest providers in the out-of-school hours care space, and they said, no, it wouldn't be in the consumer's best interest if there was one mega supplier of after-school hours care service. So they stopped that happening. So, they're asked to do inquiries about things that affect consumers, basically. And this the history to this particular inquiry is really interesting, because it first came up in 2020. Remember 2020? That was kind of that funny year that didn't really happen. Well, in that year, Albo, our PM, was then leader of the opposition. He did a budget reply speech, and it was the first time that he spoke about, if he was elected to power, he'd get the ACCC to look at essentially how consumers could get access to quality, affordable, what he called childcare. And he essentially asked them, he said he'd charge them with designing a price regulation mechanism so that every taxpayer dollar that was spent on subsidising families actually flowed through to saving families money. And I think it's interesting because that kind of language didn't kind of really make it to the final terms of reference. And I don't know whether the big corporations, et cetera, are worried about a price regulation mechanism coming out of it, but I suspect that's what the intent is.
Can I just jump on the end there, Liam, and make a remark? And that is, I think it's fair to say that by slinging this off to the ACCC, it's really clear that in the first instance, or at least in this matter, the government is viewing this as being a market problem, because the ACCC has got a specific purpose of making markets work for consumers. And if you go to the website, they'll literally say that. And the second comment I was going to make on that is, when you look at the terms of reference for the price inquiry, one of the things that struck me as curious is it doesn't, as far as I can see, have specific recommendations that the government's asking from the ACCC. And that strikes me that maybe they're using this as partly an exercise to get right down into the weeds and get some evidence together to feed into the Productivity Commission inquiry, which is going to be reporting next year. I'm not sure if you had a view on that. The Productivity Commission review has got very clear, very broad recommendations, which are in scope, that that commission can make findings on, but give feedback on.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they're looking at what causes costs to be so high rather than what do we do about it. But that's where the really interesting stuff comes in.
Yeah, well, it does. It's almost like a fist in a glove, isn't it? Because you've taken the ACCC right to the edge of saying, now, what do you think? And what do you recommend? And then it's sort of to be continued, because the Productivity Commission inquiry is very, very broad in a good way.
Yep.
Well, I think and so.
It's not a very long length of inquiry, so it really can't do huge things. It's really just, I guess, trying to get that line in the sand of what is actually happening. And then I think I like the way that you're looking at that, Carl, that it feeds the productivity inquiry, because it's really just telling us what is, and there's only time to find that out. Either I don't even think there's enough time.
Only an academic can say that's not long.
It's not long, but it is. I guess it's long enough to know what is. I mean, that's my feeling.
Okay.
Well, when you think
Carl. I was going to say, I think I suspect we're getting a little into the weeds of the detail quite early, and I'm going to put up my hand as a listener who's struggling to keep up with all of this. I think. I think Lisa's gave us a very good background there on what the ACCC is and what it does. And I know we sort of talked about some of the detail around there, but maybe, Carl, would you be able to, even just summarising even just what we sort of talked about there before we sort of go on, for essentially why is the ACCC looking at the early education sector? Why does the government think there's an issue here in terms of competition or, you know, market stuff? Sort of basic terms, why is this happening?
Well, it's very clear that, I mean, the provision of early child education care services in this country is in a market framework. And I don't see that changing as a result of the inquiry at the end of the day, the Productivity Commission inquiry. But what the ACCC does do very well is to approach the way that you gather all the information that you would be able to need the evidence to form a view on where there may be regulatory problems in a market. When you think about how they approach petrol prices, for example, that kind of thing. And so when you look at it is a natural body, I think, that you would give the task to, of going through and drawing together all of the evidence. They're very capable of doing all of that. The time frame for their report is they've got a provisional report to be handed to the Treasurer by June this year and a final report by December. And then when you look at the terms of reference relating to all of the specific points, and then maybe you want me to go into it, maybe you don't, it's very, very clear that they will be able to work with existing bureaucracies to be able to pull together all of the stuff that is reported on frequently and present that coherently in a report. And I think that's going to do, as I say, a lot of the legwork for the productivity.
That's great, Carl. Thanks. I think that gives us, just a good sense of the big picture around the ACCC. I've forgotten what it's like having four people on the podcast. I'm feeling very bossy in terms of what I'm allowing people to say or not say. But I think that's helpful. I think that just gives us a good sort of fundamental starting point. So I guess, maybe the next thing to look at will be, can we think of some examples or what's happening in the sector, the sort of evidence that there's probably an issue there? And I know that's sort of, in many ways, that's a sort of, dumb question. We sort of, where there's media articles left, right and centre about the cost of early education and all that kind of stuff. But if we're thinking particularly in terms of the private market, what are we sort of seeing in the sector that leads us to think, well, there's definitely some things that could look at. We look at with the caveat that we've obviously we shouldn't spend too much time dwelling on individuals or organisations. But what are some of the things we were sort of seeing? And I'll throw that open to anyone, I guess, who wants to tackle that one.
I'm happy to have a little go here, Liam, if that's okay. As you're right, there's four of us on here, so we're fighting for space. But I think some of the things, and everybody will add to these, are the not just in the private provision, but also as a market, is the cost of leases, the cost of the rents for particular sites, and then also the high fees making things unaffordable, where the subsidies are not passed on, I suppose, in the operational costs. And then that means that also the workforce is underpaid, and so we have these workforce impacts as well. So I think it's just that kind of the balance between access and affordability, all of those keywords that we keep talking about, flexibility. And it's about where the money goes in the end, when so much money does apparently go into early childhood education, where it actually goes.
Absolutely. And I think, I'm trying to think, if I was more prepared for this podcast, I would have the numbers to hand, but this is not a small amount of money we're talking about in terms of, just looking at the CCS, the childcare subsidy, the amount the government spends on early education each year. But we're talking, I think it's like 8 or 9 billion a year. I'm gonna get wrong, and please someone correct me. But yes, Carl, is there anything sort of to add in there, or any sort of specific examples you can think of that we're looking at?
Look, funnily enough, I don't think this is a conversation where I'd go straight to the numbers. I would be kind of keen just to go straight to some of the impressions that swirl around and have swirled around for a very long time. There is a lack of transparency around the numbers. And I think on top of that, that creates frequently the suspicion that someone somewhere is making a lot of money out of early childhood education, And that's true in part, and it's not true in other parts.
Not educators, certainly.
Thank you very much. And so you're dead right, and you come straight to it, and you go, well, who's not making money out of all of this? And I think that this is kind of, in a sense, some unfinished business from right before the ALP lost government in 2013, if you can cast your mind back that long, when literally 10 years ago this month, Bill Shorten and the then Education Minister, Peter Garrett, were up there talking about how they were going to put in place supports for educator wages and this sorts of thing, And I kind of think that some of the thinking they had at that time, which was they were keen to introduce tighter controls on fees, setting of fees, that didn't go anywhere. We ended up going down the path of having fee caps on CCS. Hourly rate caps on CCS rather than controlling the fee overall. I kind of think this comes back to this unfinished business, and I'm being very woolly in my remarks. I'll acknowledge that, and I'll just conclude by saying that centrality, that central point of that suspicion that someone somewhere is making money out of all of this, but we can't make out quite who it is pervasive.
I think we do know, you know, some points really clearly. We know that fees, that when the Treasurer announced this inquiry or gave the terms of the reference to the ACCC, he repeated the statistic that fees have gone up 41% in the past 8 years. And we also know that 20% of all revenue, which is, that's spent by the government in this space, or $1.7 billion, goes to the five largest for-profit companies, three of which are offshore, three of which are owned by people outside of Australia. So that's a lot of money bleeding all over the place out of the government's big investment. And I think it's up more about 10 or 12 billion at the moment, Liam. That's really big money, and it's going obviously not to families, obviously not to educators, but to other people.
And I think that's the point. When I sort of think about that amount of money, it's not to say that that amount of money is a poor investment. That's actually probably less than, not even probably. We know from things like, the OECD average that Australia is actually, significantly behind in terms of spending. And we know the research that, investment in early education is critical and vital and pays, all sorts of dividends socially and economically down the track. But it is a huge amount of money to spend when the government doesn't seem to have a very good tight handle on exactly these questions. Who's actually making, getting the benefit of this money? And it's not children, it's not educators, and, it doesn't seem to be families either.
I agree with you on the revenue figures, Lisa. They are massive. I think one of the very interesting things that will come out of the ACCC inquiry will be the question around profitability, because I just wonder to what extent anyone, the corporations, let's call them that, themselves are actually making profit. And it would not surprise me if it comes out at the end of the day that they are, along with all services at this point, are doing it really, really tough, and that they are a lot more marginal than we might think on the outside. And I don't say that because I want to be sticking up for them in the slightest, and I certainly don't see a role for corporate provision of childcare in this country. But that aside, I will be interested to see what the profitability comes out at.
So, Carl, are you saying that the way that profits are being represented perhaps by some of the larger corporates is encouraging investment, but they're really not true representations?
I don't think anyone's being I think there's a lot of opaqueness around the finances of the companies, and the companies that we do have the greatest visibility of are the publicly listed ones in Australia, specifically G8 and Mayfield. We also get a lot of visibility around Goodstart's figures, which of course is not for profit. For the size of the revenue, if I just take for a moment G8, their profit at the end of the day was about, after income tax, was $36 million on $900 million of revenue. Now, $36 million is a lot of money, but that's not price gouging, or that's not excessive, if I could put it in those terms, in an ACCC sense, in a corporation sense. And so I would be interested to see what the ACCC makes of that kind of return. You will appreciate that I don't have a lot of time for that particular corporation, but that's pretty marginal to me.
So does that mean they're in danger of going under, Carl?
Well, you went straight to that pretty quick. I think that I will answer you directly by saying this. I think that you would want to be careful about every service, really. I think that the sector as a whole is very precarious. Within that, I think G8 has got significant challenges with its workforce figures at the moment. I should say educators, but they say workforce. I'll just repeat their language. And
what are they, Carl?
Well, financial report shows that they've had over a 30% turnover in the year of educators, which is extraordinary. Their investor presentation last week said that, the occupancy is at 71%, and
they're unlikely to be able to dramatically improve occupancy because they physically can't get the staff to close that gap between occupancy and licensed places, you know? So even if they could find the staff, they're chasing their tail, always having, you know, turnover of staff, which is a problem across the sector, right? But in answer to your question, are they in danger of going under? I would draw your attention to the remarks the directors made in the financial reports around their ongoing concern, whether they can trade on an ongoing concern, and as a going concern, and they make a specific remark that they've concluded they have reasonable grounds to believe so. So the directors of the company say that they do. And
is that kind of damning the company with faint praise? Hey, we believe we can survive.
Well, they've got current liabilities which exceed current assets by $168 million. And that's gone up $30, $40 million on the previous year. I mean, we're in a funny world because in most environments, if current assets are less than current liabilities, you've kind of triggered one arm of being insolvent, just as a general principle. Now, the directors say that they're not. They believe that they can trade on an ongoing basis. They're across more information than we are. They hold very important positions in that company. So you can't just dismiss what they say. But I think that, let's just say this, if you were a regulator right now, you'd be probably want to have a chat with them and say, well, you know, what are you seeing that we're not?
One of the good things about the ACCC is that they've actually got the right to compel any corporation to kind of hand over pretty much whatever they ask. So they've already called, I believe, for, you know, G8's accounts in details. And so they may be able to shed some more light on that. One of the things that always strikes, I remember about G8 is that they spend about 60% of their revenue on employee expenses. And that compares, say, to Good Start, which is 70%, or someone like KU, which is 78%. So I suppose I'm not that surprised that their turnover of staff is so high, because it either suggests that they're paying shit wages or that they just don't have many staff. And as we know, that increases the stress on staff, and that's when leaving and finding a new job or exiting the sector would appear more appealing to people.
Yeah, so there's lots of interesting stuff there. I wonder, so I think we sort of looked at what the ACCC is, sort of why, I think we've got into a bit of detail there on why the government has determined that the ACCC should be looking into the sector. I wonder if anyone wants to be brave enough to maybe even just take us briefly through the terms of reference. It's very good being the host because I just assigned that to someone else, although I could, you know, put my hand up and do it myself. But we know, without just sort of reading it line by line, what will the ACCC, in terms of the terms of reference that have been provided to them by the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, what will they actually be looking into?
I can do that, Liam. I think they're looking at costs. So what makes up costs? Is it, you know, labour? How much, like, is there an availability of labour problem that has pushed up the cost of labour? Cost of land and rent, etc. Looking at finance and admin costs. Looking at the cost of regulatory compliance and those kind of things. And so once they've looked at the costs, and they'll look at whether prices have kind of changed, specifically since the Jobs for Families package was brought in by Scott Morrison in 2018. So the system that gave us the CCS and the ACCC, has prices gone up since then? And we know from the government's own report, when the Morrison government was still in power, that in fact, family outlays increased after childcare subsidy because prices did go up. They'll also look at how the kind of costs and prices differ compared to different sorts of providers and their size and their type. You know, is in-home care way more expensive than other sorts of care, and if so, why? Whether it costs more to provide care for younger children or older children. You know, if higher quality places, does it cost more to provide higher quality or less? And what affects demand? Does the amount of supply impact on demand? So, and generally just, what is all the money that we're pumping into the sector, does that actually help reduce costs for families or not? Does that sound, you've all read the terms, is that a reasonable summary?
That's an excellent summary. Thank you, Lisa. So I'm interested there because one of the things that stood out to me in terms of reading the terms of reference is that reference to labour. And it is quite high up in the terms of reference. But obviously what we're talking about there is, early childhood educators and teachers. It is kind of, it was always a bit jarring, I think, to just see it referred to as labour. But obviously that's the nature of the inquiry that's taking place and the nature of the body that's doing it. What do we think is the likelihood that this will be a further opportunity, as if we needed one, but to acknowledge the issue of the lack of professional wages and conditions for educators? Or is there a concern that, that will only be seen as a cost and it might actually be that the ACCC go, well, they've been paid too much and we're definitely not going to pay them anymore? Or is there a chance that this can be sort of part of advocacy for that big move as well?
I don't reckon that would be something that the ACCC would, something that it was going to report on. I think it looks pretty clear that it's massively a fact-finding and really important fact-finding task. And I think that might be picked up subsequently. In fact, I'm sure it will be picked up subsequently in the productivity.
So I guess the concern for me there is that if the ACCC said that if the facts are that, so we know that, regardless of whether it's 60 to, 70 to 80%, the biggest cost, obviously, in early education is the provision of qualified educators. Is there a risk that the ACCC and the Productivity Commission in this era of, reining in budget costs and doing the deficit? I'm not sure why this particularly stood out to me, but it was the first thing that absolutely did. Is there a risk that it is just seen as a cost, and despite the pretty appalling conditions faced by the overwhelmingly female-dominated workforce, that we just kind of reduce this to, a cost that needs to be reduced, and we could look at things like, having fewer qualification requirements or relaxing ratios?
Yeah, it is a market. So the market will always look to reduce costs if it's looked at in those terms. And I guess it's one of the responsibilities that we have as well is to make that, if for instance that happened, and I'm sort of looking on the bright side with Carl and saying, well, maybe, there will be no comment about that. But I think this is the advocacy efforts that need to be made to give, colour and movement to those figures, but also to make comparisons to other sectors and professions, because for example, the aged care sector, the social care sectors will always have higher labour costs and should have them because they're human services. So I think that's going to be a responsibility of the sector to really give some understanding broadly about what that means. And we have ratios. I get it. We might be looking at sort of, let's make legislative changes and do those things. But that's our role, I suppose, in this.
I actually don't think it is a danger. I think that when Albo did that budget reply speech, he kept using the word quality. And I don't think even if the ACCC did say, hey, you've got too high qualified people looking after these, that's why childcare costs so much in Australia, I don't think you'd have a bar of it. I've got faith.
goodness, I can't believe the optimism right now, but I reckon it's always a danger, isn't it? That's what Pam Carr from ECA of old times said, that there's always governments operate by stealth, so you have to be very, very careful.
Well, yeah, yes, of course, you know, and I'm not saying, you know, oh, Labor are the good guys and won't do anything wrong. We know they consistently do things wrong, but you know, I just think that it's less, they're less likely to, and we need to slough off some of our cynicism of the past, however long that appalling other mob were in power.
Liam, I want to object to this. Lisa's changing the rules of engagement right now.
I'm not getting rid of my citizens. It's like a warm, cozy blanket, Lisa. How dare you insist that I get rid of that?
Look, probably by tomorrow I'll have mine back again. Liam, can I just have a quick ramble about private equity funds?
Go for it. This is what the people have been demanding, Lisa. The amount of requests I get is like, can we please talk more about private equity funds? So please go for it, Lisa.
Precisely. Nobody wants to know about them. Nobody understands them in the sector. So I just want to tell you a little bit about private equity funds, because they're really important. So, and Liam and Carl, Leanne and Carl, you could probably correct me on this, but basically they're just kind of like where rich people put their money and then they give them to a fund manager, and the fund manager goes, oh, goody, now we've got mega bucks because all these rich people have given us money. What can we invest in to make the rich people even richer? Is that a fair kind of description of what how they work?
Totally fair, and I would add as well that typically they're looking for opportunities, not always, but typically looking for opportunities where there's a company on a stock exchange which is listed, which is not being particularly well run, that they can look at and go, ah, we can come in here and make these efficiencies, make these improvements, and like buy it, take it private, hence the private equity, and make the improvements we want, and then flip it down the track. That's a common
It's that flipping it that is of concern, because over the last, I don't know, little period, we've had 90 separate private equity funds involved in education care in Australia, or you know, 90 different purchases of services in Australia, and 63 exits. So they've bought the company, made money out of it, and got out, sold it on to someone else. So if we look at, you know, some of the big ones that were sold, it was Guardian. It was originally bought by, one of the private equity firms that bought it was called Partners, which is an offshore private equity fund. So the people with the money investing don't live in Australia. And they bought it for $440 million, I can't remember how many years ago. And they're looking to sell it this year for $1 billion. So these people have made $600 million. Is that right? Am I doing my sums right there? $600 million. Out of basically polishing up Guardian and selling it on to someone else. So that's a lot of money, you know? A lot of money being made out of taxpayer investments in children's education and care. And then the other one was Think, which was on the stock exchange, and then it was bought by Busy Bees, which is an American or a Canadian company, I think. And again, you know, just money made and then sold. Or Affinity, it was bought for $213 million. It was on the stock exchange. They bought it, took it, deregistered it, took it off the stock exchange, and 6 years later it was sold for $650 million. So these are the kind of big bucks that are being made by these funds from investing in early education and care. And to them, it doesn't matter if it's early education care or widgets or computer software chips. It's just whatever will make them money.
Yeah, it's part of that whole market, isn't it? So we've got a market, so then you can just go in and make money from it. And we've talked about that before in lots of sectors. If there's a market, then why not?
Yeah. Yeah, morality is one of the reasons why not, but yeah. And Carl, maybe you can, while we're discussing people, what did the outgoing CEO of G8 get as his retrenchment pay?
You've put me on the spot there.
Was it 800 million? No, it couldn't have been that. 8 million? 800,000, 800,000, I think.
Yeah, closer to that. I mean, anything
with too many knots and they all run.
Absolutely. And look, yeah, big figures. I don't have any further comment to make on that. You're dead right. It speaks for itself, right? But what I was going to say, can I just pick on one thing real briefly, and that is this concept of making money, right? And you're spot on when you're talking about the amount of money that can be made in buying and selling children's services. And I think it's really important to draw a distinction between the money that is made in that environment. There's a big difference between the money that is made buying and selling children's services as capital gains and actually operating services. And I think that it's that latter part which sometimes gets confused with the buying and selling, because you hear those big figures and you go, wow, and this is where the money is being made. And historically, you look back, you trace back through a lot of these services. And I'll pick on Affinity there because it's one that's, you know, that's close to my heart. That came to the market in 2013, 2014 as a group of people, primarily in Queensland, who were looking to pull together and offload their services. They were, you know, held in small groups, or one or two, an owner might have one or two services, you know, maybe five or six. They pulled them all together. And at that time, there was a great opportunity to sell them onto the stock exchange and make money, because the market was prepared to pay a premium for the children's services, you know. And I think this buying and selling of children's services is a central problem in the structure of the market.
Yeah, precisely.
All right. Thanks, Lisa and Carl. Just looking at the time, I wonder whether we want to move just briefly, maybe just from each of us, what do we hope to see from this inquiry? So when it reports, I guess we can answer that is what do we think is likely? But, you know, if in our best wishes, what would we hope would come as a result of this inquiry? I might start with our special guest, Carl, first.
Okay. I think in the spirit of it, I've got to say two things, don't I? The first thing I'd like to see I would like to see reams and reams of data, which is not actually, you know, available to the sector as a whole, around all of the points that they've been directed to consider. So specifically, I'd like to see a lot of the data that gets reported to the Commonwealth through the childcare subsidy system, you know, the daily fees and the CCS that comes back. It doesn't need to be identified, of course, but just aggregated. I'd love to see all of that made publicly available. Secondly, I would love to see a really strong, considered analysis of the profit in running children's services of all types.
Thank you, Carl. Leanne, what would you like to see coming out of the inquiry?
What Carl said at the beginning about do we really know exactly what's happening in this landscape in early childhood education in Australia? And this is a great opportunity to find out and to really have that, and I hope that they can do it in that time, and to really have that evidence there. And, you know, we don't spend enough money on early childhood education. We think we do because it's a big number. But when we look at the stats across the OECD, we can see that we sit in the middle, but in actual fact, the spending is not going directly to education and directly to children. And so that's something that I think I'm hoping will come out, and that we will understand and have more public awareness that money is actually going essentially to the world of the world rather than education, but the world of childcare and education, that then may be somebody may be profiting from that. And so, you know, in an unreasonable manner. And I really hope that we can find that out. And I also hope that following that, we can look to other the way other countries are managing this, because there are markets in other countries and there are things like fee caps and ways of regulating the market that's happening internationally and even in this kind of mixed market model that we have. So I'm just... I just want all my questions answered. I think that's fair enough, isn't it?
Very fair. Lisa, what about you?
Look, I want them to do a report that makes the government read it and go, oops, our bad. Apparently the market isn't the best way of providing education and care to children. We're going to stop all marketeering in the sector. I think that'd be awesome. But if they can't do that, then I'd at least like them to look at two things, the private equities and corporations. And the second one is how much is being made from landlords, property trusts that are renting, developing and renting premises to providers at inflated rent.
Thank you, Lisa. Look, I think I agree with all of those points. I don't think I have anything specific to add. I might just add, I just have the produce report I can read and understand without having to send too much of it to Leanne or Carl or you, Lisa, to translate for me. That's all I'm after. I'd be happy with that.
Liam, you understand way more than you pretend you understand.
You're just pretending.
If only that were true. I mean, Carl in particular, maybe it's because I mainly go to him with random questions, go, Carl, what does this mean? And then I sound smart later on. just don't tell anyone about that, Carl. That would be great.
Liam, we all do.
No, I'm very embarrassed to hear you say that, because I think that most of my mumblings and murmurings aren't entirely coherent most of the time. Thank you. I'll take it as a compliment.
All right. Well, I think that was a great discussion. I think probably the only other thing to maybe flag is, we are obviously a podcast dedicated to advocacy and activism. Are there any ways that actually listeners can get involved? I think this is a bit different than some of the other inquiries where there'll be sort of more opportunities for sort of public submissions and stuff. But is there actually any way for the sector to get involved in this inquiry?
So there'll be their interim report in June. I presume that'll be a public interim report, and then they'll probably publish a consultation paper with potential draft recommendations in September. You know, but I'd say if anyone, you know, wanted to just drop them an email saying, hey, I really hope you're going to consider private equity, corporations, landlords, etc., then, yeah, that shows that we're watching and interested in what they're doing.
And there's an invited stakeholders group. So maybe by doing something like that, Lisa, people are alerting them to perspectives and they might get invited. They might get an invitation to the party.
Oh, yeah, sure, right. People like us are never, well, occasionally you are, Leanne, but the rest into the tent consultations with government.
Just if people are sort of putting forward as you've suggested, then it is highlighting that and perhaps notice will be taken.
There ain't no party like an ACCC party. One of the things we brought back in terms of, I should say thank you all for that discussion. I certainly know a lot more about the ACCC inquiry than I did when I hit record a little while ago. One of the things we brought back for this year is just a recommendation each fortnight. And I should say I gave Carl very limited notice of this, so he can get a pass out if he wants, but Leanne and Lisa have no such excuse.
Well, I like the OECD policy brief on employment, labour and social affairs. Is childcare affordable? And it's only about 13 pages long and it's very interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of fun stuff coming out of the OECD.
That's my recommendation. And I think that's the one that's kind of most sort of in line as well with the subject matter today, which I think, and it's a very easy read, very enjoyable.
Carl, is there anything you want to direct people to? Oh,
look, yes. Can I give you, I'll send you a link to put on the website if I may. I reckon that if you haven't checked out some of the testimony at the Robodebt Royal Commission, specifically from the victims, and I'd say there are two classes of victim. There are the people who have served these unlawful debt notices, and there are the employees in the lower level, the frontline employees in the bureaucracies. I would strongly recommend anyone go and have a look at those, but particularly if you're an educator, I would say just have a check out the experience of an affected employee.
Oh, 100% agree. I'm going to give myself a bonus recommendation here. I would add to that, like, specifically the reporting of Rick Morton for the Saturday paper.
Yeah.
Has just been fantastic, and he actually does a daily live blog, I think, of it as well, and has just been excoriating of all the waffling feedback of everyone involved. My recommendation, so we're approaching International Women's Day. It'll be 2 days from when this podcast starts. In the past, we've done an episode sort of focused on it, but it sort of has fallen between our records. And I don't know if we've got anything new to say about the intersection. I think if you want to go back and look at our podcast library, we've done, I think, 3 or 4 episodes on it, and we've ranted and raved as much as we can. What I would recommend, though, is that you check out the Respect at Work website at respectatwork.gov.au. So the government passed legislation last year, which was an update to the Sex Discrimination Act, which puts a positive duty on organisations to provide a workplace that is free from workplace sexual harassment and discrimination. If you're thinking, surely that law already existed, you should think that, but unfortunately it didn't. It relied on an individual making a complaint, and we, I think, are very well aware in our society that puts a really unfair onus on particularly women to come forward and tackle power structures that protect themselves and their organisations rather than individuals. So this is really positive legislation. The respect, and I should say Leanne and I had the privilege of actually hearing the Sex Discrimination Commissioner who did all the work that led to this legislative change, Kate Jenkins, speak at the press club last year. It was pretty amazing, pretty inspiring. So it's really positive legislation. I think for the sector, which is, you know, 96% women, and also, you know, has a strong, you know, a group of people from migrant backgrounds who are vulnerable in a whole range of, or experiencing vulnerability in a whole range of other ways, it's really important that early education workplaces are safe. We know they are not immune from sexual harassment and discrimination, and actually, in fact, the power imbalances are often greater given those kind of things. So this is really fantastic. Organisations have until October to be ready and to be able to demonstrate to the Human Rights Commission that they are proactively taking steps to ensure they are safe and not just relying on responding to complaints. So respectatwork.gov.au will have the link on the website as well.
That sounds great. I came up with mine, Liam. The G8 annual report. I specifically direct people to page 9, which is their strategic plan for the next few years, where they say that they want stable, engaged teams with a retention rate of 80%, delivering high-quality outcomes for children with 95% of their services being quality, which leads to greater experiences for families and increased occupancy of 80%. So given that we know that their occupancy is 71% and their retention was about 35%, then it's a fun page to look at and just think, geez, I've got a lot of work to do, guys. Wouldn't want to be that incoming CEO.
Well, I want to thank Lisa and Leanne, as always, with a big special thanks to Carl for once again joining us on the podcast. It's a delight to have you back, Carl. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's been fun.